Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, big primary day, the 4th of March. We're happy to have Martin Fletcher with us this first hour of our program today. Martin is NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv and has written a fascinating book, Breaking News, a stunning and memorable account of reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world. He writes, getting a good story while maintaining one's humanity is difficult, yet it's hardly the only ethical challenge he's faced. How polite should I be when interviewing someone responsible for killing up to 2 million Cambodians? Is it wrong to stay in the home of a brutal Somali warlord eating lavish food prepared by his Italian-trained chef in order to report on, among other things, his theft of the same food from international aid organizations? Martin has covered almost every conflict and natural disaster in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East for 35 years now. He has won 5 Emmys, several Overseas Press Club Awards, and a Cameraman's Award. He's covered the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the crisis in the Persian Gulf, began his Tel Aviv assignment in 1982, and joined NBC News as a cameraman in August of 1977. He's also been based in Johannesburg, Paris, and Frankfurt. He's reported on the war on terror in Afghanistan, the conflict in Kosovo, and has reported from Berlin when the walls came down, and from China in the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square massacre during the American hostage situation in November of 1979 in Tehran. He was the first TV correspondent to enter the American embassy, and he was arrested at that time. He's covered all kinds of things. The battles between Iraq and Iran, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Israeli-Lebanese clashes, and began his news career. We'll start with maybe his beginning in this field in 1970. He was born in London and has also worked as a French and German interpreter for the common market. We'll be welcoming phone calls. There is so much to talk about with him that, you know, take it in any of those directions, Kosovo or the Middle East, Afghanistan, you name it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Martin Fletcher, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen, thank you so much for having me. My head is spinning just listening to that list.
You've done a lot in your life. Doesn't it make you feel like you've done a lot?
I've done a lot and seen a lot, and I guess that's why I decided I should write the book, you know. But unfortunately, there's been such an emphasis on bad news. But I've covered some pleasant stories too, I hope.
Yeah, and you could have had, as you write early on, a cushy job as a French and German interpreter for the common market. You did that for a while, but something put you in another direction. How did that happen?
Well, it was boring. It was boring. It was a great job. It was, as you say, it was very cushy, and many people who I was working with then at that time are still doing it. But you know, I was just too interested in traveling and seeing the world, and hopefully getting someone to pay for it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And journalism seemed the obvious choice. So I was a bit, you know, young and clueless in the beginning. But I hope that's changed.
Yeah. So you arrive in Israel, you know, you're swimming, you're doing the backstroke and having a lovely time, and 5 days later, there's a war that breaks out, and you didn't quite anticipate that, did you?
Well, no, actually, I arrived in Israel the 1st of October, 1973, and I was going to meet some friends on the beach, and I was doing the, as you say, doing the backstroke, and they didn't turn up. One was a photographer, and I suddenly put two and two together from different things, the different hints that I'd received in the few days before, and as I was swimming, I suddenly understood there's a war on. So that was my introduction to war. I had to rush up to the Golan Heights. I didn't even know where it was.
Oh, my gosh. And you talk, I mean, this is a profession that's filled with such tremendous risk that you have a good chance of dying before you retire, Martin.
Well, I'm close to retirement. Maybe I've made it. I hope so.
All right.
Yeah, but I've got so many friends, close friends, you know, who did die. It is a dangerous job. There are plenty of dangerous jobs, but this is certainly one of them. And, of course, you know, as I write in the book, you know, I try to come to terms with why one does this kind of work. And I write that I can understand, you know, why a fireman would enter a burning building or why a soldier would go to war. But, you know, why would you put your life in risk repeatedly just basically to tell a story? It doesn't seem to make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to come to grips with why I did that in the book, yeah.
Right, because the stories are stories we have to hear.
I think so. I mean, at a certain point, I just became look, to be honest, in the beginning it was excitement when I was a young man, and at a certain point I just understood that what I was witnessing was history, and then the turning point was when I understood I wasn't just witnessing events, but I was joining people in their lives at their lowest moments, and that's when I really grew as a person, I think, and became probably a better TV journalist, because I started relating so much to the people and their problems. And, I was with one man, for instance, in the Sudan, and I just happened to look him in the eyes just at the moment that he realized that his infant, who he was holding in his hands, was dead.
Mm.
And I saw that, you know, his eyes and my eyes, he looked up and our eyes met, and I realized, and he started crying, and, you know, and sort of walked off with his dead child in his arms. And my instinct as a reporter was to go find the cameraman quickly and say, hey, follow that guy, you know, which is a horrible reaction. But at the same time, that's what I was there to do. And that those kinds of moments stay with you. You know, they really stay with you. And cumulatively, I guess I built up a lot of experience, pain inside me, really.
Right, right. And some of that comes from your family. Tell me about your mother and your father. They were one of the few people from both of their families to escape from the Holocaust.
Yeah, they were very lucky. My parents, mother and father, both escaped from Vienna in 1939. My father was actually jailed at one point. My mother left Vienna the day before an arrest warrant was put out to arrest her. And they managed to flee, and both of their families were almost completely wiped out in the Holocaust. My mother's sister escaped and went to Los Angeles, and my father's niece escaped and went to, guess where she lives now. Wauwatosa, Wisconsin.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding me.
Dolly Rothman, I'm sure she's listening.
Oh.
And her family, Lynn and Susan and everybody. So the only relatives I have in the States are a couple of relatives from my mother's sister and my family in Wisconsin.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? And you also talk about your parents being refugees at heart, and they pass some of that on to you. Tell me more about that. What do you mean?
Well, you know, that's something I never understood until I was deeply into my career, and people kept saying to me, you know, why are you doing this? It's so risky. And then I began to understand that I think it's true to say that the pain of my parents at what happened to their families was never passed on to me openly in a spoken word. My parents didn't talk about the Holocaust, but my father was always lighting candles, and he'd say, this is in memory of Aunt this, this is in memory of Uncle that, this is the day I escaped from jail, this is the day I was put in jail. And there's constant memorial dates, but without any real story behind them about what happened. And my mother never said a word about anything. And so the closer I became to other people suffering in Rwanda, in Sarajevo, in Somalia, all these places, at a certain point I began to understand that the suffering I was witnessing was helping me understand the suffering of my own family.
Yeah.
And it was quite a momentous event for me when I understood, maybe that's why I'm so interested in the victims in conflict. Maybe that's why I go do this all the time.
Right.
I don't know if it's true, but I think psychologically it's possible. And there's a whole syndrome they call second-generation syndrome, where the children of Holocaust survivors understand that they themselves have got terrible psychological problems, which have been passed on unwittingly by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And people say to people like me, what are you worrying about? You know, you're all right. You know, you grew up in London. What's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are many issues that parents have put onto their children, of course, that we still carry around. And I think many Jewish children of survivors are scarred by that, many without even knowing it.
Yeah. I think you could write a whole book, Martin, about your mother and father, because I was so captivated by it. It was just a paragraph that you wrote about your father, who obviously was brilliant, who had books all around him, but who really wouldn't talk to you about events or what he was reading. The conversation was just cut short.
Well, he would always quiz me. He had a tremendous interest in world affairs, and he was a real linguist. He read his books in seven languages.
Oh, my gosh.
Including Greek and Latin.
Ah!
Yeah, so he was a brilliant man, but he was a very closed man as well. And he was always interested in what I had to, you know, where I was going. But then he'd always sort of, he'd always interrupt the conversation. He had a very short attention span, I guess. And then in the middle of a conversation with me, when I'd be telling him about, say, Kosovo, after about a minute of that, he'd just take his hearing aid out and return to his books. But
but he never had a chance to read your book, did he?
No, that's a pity. None of my family did. My brother, mother, and father all died within a short period of time, a couple of years ago. So that's a great pity.
Yeah. I pick up today's New York Times and front page story, and how many headlines have we seen almost identical to this? As Israelis pull out of Gaza, Hamas celebrates its rocketry. It goes, and you've been covering this for so long, it goes on and on and on and on and on, Martin. Isn't it discouraging that it goes on and on and on?
Well, it is discouraging, I must say. I mean, one reason I stayed so long in Israel was I always thought that peace was around the corner.
Mm.
And I'm sort of finding out really how rather naive I was. I mean, we have Condoleezza Rice in Israel today, actually. And this morning, she made another statement saying, I believe there will be peace between Israel and the Palestinians by the end of 2008. You know, well, that's such nonsense. And it's not going to happen. They're not even going to have an agreement. Everybody knows that. But continually, you know, sticking to the spin doesn't help the process. And it is sad because the violence is just cyclical. And there doesn't seem to be a way around it. And I suppose that by setting dramatic standards like peace by the end of 2008, now you're moving away from processes that may be more achievable, like simply a ceasefire and an extended ceasefire, maybe a much more realistic aim to go for.
Mm-hmm. How difficult was it for you? You write about this. You're the son of Holocaust survivors, and you're covering this conflict. Is it? And you seem to be able to see the suffering on both sides. And I would think that it took a while to get to that, considering what your background was. How are you able to see both sides of the suffering?
Well, I've always been. Well, actually, you know, that's an interesting question because it does come, I think, straight out of what we talked about earlier. As I grew up as a young Jewish guy in London, and you know the whole story, I naturally sympathized with victims, and I always had this antipathy to bullies, and that was as a child, and that's I think continued with me into my career. And one of the issues that I guess I have is that what do you do when your own people can be seen as the bullies, and when the other people may can be seen as the victims? And I know this is a very difficult thing to say, and it's quite controversial. But the bottom line is that if you go from the Jewish side to the Muslim side, the Israeli side, the Palestinian side, there's terrible suffering on both sides. And I don't believe that because I come from a certain background, therefore I have to automatically promote that view. You know, mm-hmm. I'm a journalist before everything, and. And I try to see both sides. And when you get to see the Palestinians and the way they live and the problems they have, even though a lot of it is self-imposed, no doubt about it. But still, you know, you're with a boy, a Palestinian boy, and then he grows up to be a man. He's known nothing else but living in a refugee camp. The only Israeli he's ever seen in his life is in a uniform and carrying a gun. Obviously, his attitude is going to be of a very certain attitude. And to dismiss his attitudes and dismiss his anger is wrong, and so I try to understand both sides, but it is sometimes very confusing for me.
Yeah, and so why is it that it's so hard for other people to share your viewpoint of understanding both sides?
I think when you're with the people, things look different. It's easy if you're in America and you're Jewish, or if you're in America and you're Arab, it's easy to hate the other side. And
mm-hmm.
of course, in a conflict, it's very important to dehumanize the enemy. That's part of what you have to do in order to win a conflict or to continue with the conflict. But when you see people and you're in their homes, and I've been in the homes of survivors of suicide bombs, and I've been in the home of people who sent those suicide bombers. I've done that repeatedly, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, okay, one is genuine, and the Palestinian guy who sends a suicide bomber, he is a terrorist by any definition, including my own. But still, I can listen to what he says, and I can listen to his background,
mm-hmm.
and I can understand where he comes from. And I have arguments with them, too. I mean, I've had stand-up, you know, verbal battles with masked guys with guns, telling them that they're just killers. And that didn't go down very well.
I would imagine that's a little dangerous for you to do,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't go down very well. But, I mean, I guess I was supported by the fact my cameraman was filming it. If anything happened, it would be on camera, you know.
Right.
So maybe I was playing to the camera a little bit. I don't know, to be fair. But the fact is that, you know, I have those conversations, And I also have conversations with the families of victims who then say, oh, we've got to kill all the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nonsense, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to do my bit to be a bridge, I guess.
Yeah. So much of the news, as you well know, is reported through the eyes of those who are the powerful, those who are the rich and sometimes corrupt and powerful. I was interested in what you said earlier, that you are much more interested in people and their problems, and those are the stories that you go after. Why?
Well, I've never, for instance, I also write that I'm proud that I've rarely interviewed a head of state or a CEO or a top army general. You know, I haven't been involved with policy makers. I tended to be more interested in the results of policy. In other words, what happens on the ground to the people. And why, I guess, I think we've partly gone over that, I guess, in terms of my family background. And I think I just I'm more attracted naturally to trouble, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's just more interesting to me to go into the refugee camps, to go to Rwanda or Somalia. I'll give you an example. I was in Uganda about 6 weeks ago doing a story on the success, the dramatic success of Uganda's struggle against AIDS. Mm-hmm. And it's gone down from 1 in 5 to 1 in 15 people there in a rather short period of time. And the American embassy there said, oh, you must interview the ambassador about this. And apparently he doesn't speak very often to the media. And I said, I don't want to speak to the ambassador. I want to go and speak to some, you know, to the people. Mm-hmm. And so I went out and I spent a lot of time with the with Ugandans in villages, driving around for hours. And we did a story that was all about the people. We didn't have one official in the story. We didn't get one diplomatic reaction to it. Just the people. This is their life. And that's what I find interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to, there's so many places to go with you. Let's go to Afghanistan for a moment. You were reporting, actually, you walked with, I think, people, the Mujahideen, as they were going into Afghanistan, or as they were fighting the Soviets. You covered the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. What were your thoughts at that time? Did you see trouble down the road, Martin?
My first thought was, what the hell am I doing here? I got myself into so
right.
much trouble.
Oh, my gosh.
And but what I learned was, yeah, I know I didn't really see what was going to happen down the road. I must say, I wasn't very particularly prescient. I was actually just trying to get out safely. But when looking back, I understood that the people I was with were, in fact, the seeds of Taliban and al-Qaeda, which they were. I mean, when I was in Peshawar in 1980, looking for Mujahideen to take me into Afghanistan, I was by myself, and I had to find people to trust in a town where there was nobody trustworthy, by the way. Mm. Osama bin Laden was there. We know that he was there at the same time, for instance. So that was the roots of today's Islamic terrorism in Afghanistan and in Iran, where I was too. I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, my experiences there and the conversations I had with the Mujahideen as we spent 3 weeks walking through the mountains of the Hindu Kush into Pakistan, I had a translator, and I was talking to them all the time. That gave me a tremendous insight into what they were doing and why, which is basically as valuable today as it was then. It helps me understand Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, what's going on in Iraq. You know, that was the beginning of this wave of Islamic terror.
Yeah. So how do you determine who you can trust, not only there, but in all the other places you've been?
It's a wing and a prayer, frankly. And you know, I in the book I write about I called a Daniel Pearl moment, you know, which many journalists who do the kind of work I do have, you know, which is at a certain point, you know, you want to get a story and someone's going to take you somewhere to get it, and do you go with this person?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's happening many times, but the example I wrote about in the book was in Mogadishu, where after General Adid, who was the main warlord there, who was the man responsible for, whose men killed the 18 American soldiers, you know, which became Black Hawk Down. He was on the run, and I was trying to find him. And I knew him because, as a matter of fact, in my three previous visits, I stayed as his house guest.
Mm-hmm.
And so while he was on the run, I thought I could find him. And in fact, I found his people. And they sent somebody at night to come pick me and my crew up, my producer and cameraman. And the guy they sent, I didn't know him. And it was nighttime, and there was a curfew, and there was a shoot to kill going on outside, and I had to decide whether to trust this guy. And it came down to, well, this is an incredible interview. It's a real scoop if we get General Adid. The whole world's looking for him, and no one's, you know, we can be the first to find him.
Right.
And we found, I think that in the end we decided to go, and we found him, and all was well. But, you know, there's no rule book. There's no rule book, and it's all a matter of experience and above all luck.
Right, yeah. You also had a family, and they must have worried so much about you, or they just put somewhere in their head and their souls, well, he could get hurt, but the work he's doing is very important. How did they deal with that, your children, your wife?
I think with my wife, it was more a sort of don't ask and don't tell policy.
Mm.
I'd come back from all these places, and she'd say, so how was it in Sarajevo? And I'd say, I was okay.
Oh, gee.
And that was it. That was the whole conversation.
Yeah.
And my children, was all they really cared about was, what did you bring me? So, yeah, I just like a day at the office for me was not most people's day at the office. But my wife, when she read the book, then understood what I'd been doing all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And not that she's stupid. I mean, she was a sergeant in the Israeli army. Mm-hmm. I mean, she knows. But it just didn't really open her mind to what was going on. And when she read the book, that's it. I've now been grounded.
You're going to have early retirement now, right?
Yeah, well, I'm a bit too old for early retirement.
Martin Fletcher is our guest, and his book has just been released, Breaking News, a stunning and memorable account of reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world. He has covered almost every conflict, natural disaster in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East for 35 years, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. You can talk about the war on terror in Afghanistan. You can talk about Kosovo. He's been, as I said, news bureau chief in Tel Aviv for a number of years now, so we can talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the latest prospects for peace, if there are any at all in that part of the world. We can talk about Iran. We can talk about Iraq. He's covered all of this. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. And our lines are open for you and Martin Fletcher right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, you probably read about this study in last week's newspapers. It was a study of 17-year-olds determining how much they knew about history and how much they knew about literature. And the findings were pretty darn sad. We will talk with the author of Still at Risk, What Students Don't Know Even Now About How to Achieve Excellence When It Comes to Understanding History and Reading Good Books. Martin Fletcher is with us now, 800-486-8655. He is NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv, and his book, just published, Breaking News. We start our calls with Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Good morning to your guests. My question would be, based upon this fabulous experience that you've had, and, you know, not what the politicians say or think or, you know, pronounce, but up close and personal with the people, what do you think is going to happen in the short and medium term in that region? And what do you think the United States should be doing? Not what it's doing, but what should we be doing?
In the Middle East?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mike, it's such a complicated issue. I mean, clearly there's a debate in America about whether to pull the army out of Iraq straight away or slowly or wait, see the whole thing through. And I guess that's the main import of your question. But one thing that is quite instructive is the attitude of the, let's say, the Arab world towards America and towards the elections here now, because the two go so much together. There's a sense in the Arab world that America, for years, has been unfair to the Arabs and has not taken seriously its concerns. And there's a feeling also that the new American president has to be somebody who's going to take American concerns more seriously. And by that, what they're talking about is basically get out of Iraq and leave behind stability. You know, how you do that, that's so far, it's a huge debate, and it's defeating the great minds, but the American military is still staying there. I think that the important thing at some point is to set a, personally, I think the important thing is to set a timetable and try and stick to it. But I'm not naive. I don't think for a minute that America is going to be able to leave Iraq and it's all going to be peaceful afterwards. There's going to be they're going to leave behind a power struggle in which the country most poised to succeed at the moment, probably, is Iran.
Hmm. A follow-up?
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Oh, okay, you touch on Iran, and, you know, that's a big boogeyman in the area. How serious do you see them being as far as, you know, this capability for nuclear weapons and their meddling throughout the region?
Well, I guess when I say the theoretical capability is very strong. Iran is a very powerful nation. I mean, where I'm based and where I live in Israel, there's always this issue of who's going to stop the Iranian nuclear program? If nobody else does it, will Israel attack? Well, you know, that's a joke. Israel's got, you know, 7 million people. Iran is a country of 70 million people. It's a very big country, and it's, because of oil, an extremely wealthy country. And they're going full speed ahead in, with all kinds of development. Whether they're trying to build a nuclear bomb or not, I'm not the person to judge that. But the fact is, their size and their weaponry make them very influential in the region. At the same time, there's what the, Iran is not a monolithic state. All we hear about are the crazy calls from Ahmadinejad. But behind him, there's a more moderate part of the leadership is more moderate. And I think I'm right in saying that 60% of Iranians are under the age of 25, and they're mostly not supportive of the religious establishment. Having said that, doesn't mean there's going to be a revolution anytime soon. I mean, most of the history of the Middle East is based on a minority controlling a majority through the strength of the Secret Service. Mm-hmm. So I don't see necessarily that there's any real danger that these young people can overthrow the government. But if I can just extend on that a little bit. One thing that was in my career that was absolutely remarkable to me was in 1980 when I went into Tehran during the revolution against the Shah. I remember flying in on the plane. I write about this in the book. I remember flying in on the plane, and it was a long approach over the airport, Mehrabad Airport, and there were miles of government tanks and planes and helicopters and vehicles and gunships all lined up along the tarmac. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, there's no way the Khomeini's ever going to defeat the Shah. The people are never going to be able to do anything against all this weaponry. And then the next day I was out in the streets, and there were 2 million Iranians on the streets, packing every street, you know, shoulder to shoulder. And then I remember thinking, well, there's no way the Shah can use all this equipment against all these people. But I think that when the people, if the people ever did stand up, their power is tremendous. But I don't see it happening.
Mm-hmm. And go back just a little bit before that to 1979 when you entered the American embassy, your arrest at that time, how that happened.
I was outside the gate like everybody, like all the press, you know, filming the daily demonstrations that were happening that the Iranians were organizing. And, you know, typical Fletcher, I thought, I've got to do something different. And so we went with my cameraman. I went on the roof of a building opposite that looked down on top of inside the grounds of the embassy. And the cameraman zoomed into a door, just at random.
Uh-huh.
When we came down, we were immediately picked up by these revolutionary guards who took our tape and pushed us around and let us go. I went back the next day, and it turned out the door he'd zoomed in on was what they called, quote, the secret door. So they grabbed me and pulled me inside the embassy and roughed me up a little bit and said, what are you doing filming our secret door? So I got no idea what you're talking about. And then they kept me for a day, and they took me to my hotel room and searched it and pushed me inside the car. There were 6 guys with guns and combat jackets around me inside this small car. And I just thought, oh, great, I'm going to get a great story out of this. And because I wasn't a spy. But then when they searched my room, they came back and said, right, we got you. We know.
Oh.
What are you talking about? What have you found? And then they took me back to the embassy. But I was actually released unharmed after 8 hours. But it was a bit dramatic. I wasn't worried in the slightest in the beginning. But it became pretty serious for a few hours.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to the tape?
You know what? Good question. I've got no idea.
Thanks.
I didn't care by that time.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Our number, we have some lines open if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. Martin Fletcher is our guest, NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv, and he's the author of Breaking News, just published. We go next to Bill from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from a cell phone, so I hopefully won't get cut off here. But basically, my question is this. When I was a kid, the history books had a map of with Palestine on it. There was the country of Palestine. Now, today, we don't see that any longer. And I think one of the things that's troubling to me is that, at least in America, we don't get a sense, even though through fine journalistic reporting like you do, we don't get a sense of the need for these people to have a place to live, to live their lives, just as the Israelis need the same. And I'm wondering why that is in today's media. We don't see that side of the story. We see basically the viewpoint of the leaders who want to politicize this and so forth. But from a human standpoint, why is it that we don't see that kind of story in the media? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Bill, I think that's a fair question, and it's an important question. My answer would be that, in fact, from what I know, we do a lot of stories about the Palestinians and their lives and their problems. And one of the complaints I have about the media is that we focus on stories so much only when there's violence, and then we cover the violence, and then we do a couple of sort of background reports related to the violence, and then you don't hear from us again until the next outburst of violence. And that creates a rather distorted view of the region, not only the Israeli-Palestinian region, but almost any region. And so the emphasis is always on conflict, whereas the real lives, the daily lives of the people don't get reported on so much. Now, I personally try very hard to show the lives of the people and the Palestinians and of the Israelis. And I would take a little bit of exception with you. I think that the numbers of stories we do showing the Palestinian life is without a doubt about equal to the number of stories we do showing Israeli life. And the emphasis of people when they ask those kinds of questions normally comes from their own perspective. You know, Israeli supporters will always say, oh, always showing the Palestinian life, and what about us? And then the people who support the Palestinians say the opposite. I personally believe that we're pretty balanced overall in the numbers of stories we do, but the focus of those stories, they become just more emphasized at times of violence, and then you don't really remember the stories about lifestyles. We remember the stories about the violence,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a pity.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric, thank you, Bill, very much for your call. I got to this earlier in the show, but it's worth repeating, I think. When talking about the Middle East, you say that only a genuine peace process that offered real hope to both sides had a chance of ending the daily violence, and you've reported on so many really poignant scenes, tragic deaths, deaths of children, horrible scenes. But I continue with your writing. With the doubts persisting about the true motives of Palestinian and Israeli leaders, extremists succeeded in tripping up every step toward agreement. Day after day, as I trudged to another gut-wrenching scene, I wondered, how long will this tragedy go on? How in the world will it ever end? You still have the same questions, or do you have answers to that, Martin?
Tom Brokaw once said to me that it isn't the questions that make problems; it's the answers. And I don't have any answers. And the only thing I would say is that it's only by talking that the violence gets delayed or stopped. It's only by real hope of progress in the talks that there can be a lull in the violence. Now the problem is, it's almost gone too late. People always said to the Israelis, if you don't make peace with Yasser Arafat, you're going to get Hamas. And they're never going to want peace with you. And, of course, that's what's happened. So now Israel has to deal with Hamas in Gaza. And Hamas has said part of their charter is they want to destroy Israel. They're not interested in an agreement. So how do you resolve that? That rather takes the ground from under this, what I just said about peace being the only way to peace hopes being the only way to stop the violence. Because what we see now is that whenever there is any progress towards peace towards peace talks, the extremists on both sides then try and trip it up, especially mm-hmm. Hamas. And we saw that just last week. Israel and the Palestinians are trying to reach an agreement in Jerusalem, according to President Bush's schedule of getting a deal by the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamas has been, and its people in Gaza, have been firing more and more rockets at Israel to provoke Israel's response in order to stop the peace process, and for other reasons too. And, by the way, as a genuine statement saying that, you know, the war is not over until our people in the West Bank have what they need, too. But all this taken together means that any movement towards peace will now face the obstacle of the extremists,
mm-hmm.
in this case the Palestinians are rocketing from Gaza. So it's a problem to see how there's going to be any move forward. But having said that, Israelis and Palestinians now, as a result of the most recent fighting, are talking more and more of, let's drop the idea of a peace process, let's just come to reach a working arrangement where we can live side by side for a period of time and not be so not set ourselves such dramatic, unreachable goals as peace.
Right.
Which is a pity, but yeah. That's the way it is.
Yeah. Eric is next from Appleton. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. Pretty much everybody knows that these lines were drawn by England. And I was wondering, do the people still feel that they are Iraqis, or do they have more of a loyalty to their clan or ethnic group? Is the possibility of splitting these countries up a possibility, or still seen as a possibility for the people, or is it just the government holding it together?
Well, you know, that's a really critical question, and it's very important. I don't know how to answer the question specifically for Iraq, because, you know, there, of course, you have the Sunnis and the Shiites and the Kurds, and each one has its own loyalty, the Sunnis in the center to themselves, the Shiites to Iran, the Kurds to the Kurdish group in Turkey as well. I think it's clear that the Kurds would like, if they could, their own state. I mean, they said it, but they also said they're not going to break up the state of Iraq, but they want extreme independence, you know, within a confederation of Iraq, and the Shiites to a lesser extent in the south. But without getting bogged down with, like, you know, all the different groups, overall, your point is very true. These lines were drawn by the colonialists, and they're artificial lines, and that's exactly what we see, for instance, today in Kenya, where you have 43 tribes, all of whom fighting for power. The key ones ended up in the elections almost at war with each other. I was there about 6 weeks ago, the Kikuyu and the Luo. That was very close to a real war. And the issue in Africa, the Middle East, in Africa, for instance, is that when the colonialists went in there and drew up the lines to create their own areas of influence in the 19th century, at that time, there were about 10,000, early 19th century, there were about 10,000 tribal or ethnic groupings in Africa, all with their own loyalties to their own families and clans. And the colonialists got onto the, you know, took out their map and drew with pen and paper, and they reduced all that to 43 countries, each of which had its own internal tensions. And the lines, at some point, in no country did they make sense. There was always a point of contention in each place. So those are the conflicts we see today, that the groups of coexisting very uncomfortably and also unnaturally within those colonial lines. So will they eventually divide up into smaller groupings? I don't think so, but it's just very dangerous. That's where all these conflicts come from.
Mm. The effects of those years of colonialism live on and on and on, don't they, Martin?
Yeah, that's what happened in Rwanda. You know, mm-hmm. In Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis, by the way, which we call, you know, the Tutu tribe, the Tutsi tribe and the Hutu tribe, there's no such thing. There was never a difference, a tribal difference ever between the Hutus and the Tutsis until the Germans and the Belgians moved in and organized things along colonial lines. And the Tutsis were elevated to a sort of dominant position in society, even though they were only 10% of the population. And that led to strains within the society.
Yeah.
And to the terrible genocide that we've seen.
How do you feel, having been in all of these places, to look at the horrible lack of response on the part of the world community, and particularly the United States, in trying to lessen the terrible things happening in places like Rwanda and Darfur?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say especially the United States personally, because I mean, you know, in America we can be responsible for what happens in what Americans do, but actually the whole world stood by, and it is not that America did any less than anybody else. Maybe America, you could say, should have done more because they're more powerful, and that's certainly possible. But everybody closed their eyes, and including myself. I'm no hero. I mean, I was in Rwanda at the beginning of the genocide, and I covered it. And then, you know, I walked away and went back to Israel, and it was my wife's 40th birthday, and I won a championship sailing race, and I carried on with my life. Mm. And then, meanwhile, 800,000 people were being killed, which we knew was proceeding, and nobody did anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rwanda is one of the great blemishes of our generation, I think. We knew what was going on. And we all said, oh, my God, after the Holocaust, you know, never again. And then after Cambodia, we said never again. Mm-hmm. And then Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, since Rwanda, we've had 5.5 million people killed in the Congo in a decade. 5.5 million, the largest single loss of life since the Second World War. And I bet you that the three people in your audience who even know what's going on in the Congo.
Yeah. More than that, it's public radio. You know?
I was hoping you wouldn't say, well, tell us, because I wouldn't be able to.
Martin Fletcher is our guest. He is NBC Bureau, News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv, and he's the author of a really good book. He's covered so much, 35 years. He's been all over the world covering Europe and Africa and the Middle East. And the book is Breaking News, a stunning and memorable account of reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after the news from National Public Radio, a study released last week of 17-year-olds. Multiple choice, 33 questions given to these young people who are about to take over ruling this country. And the findings here, they were looking at what they knew about history and what they knew about literature. About a quarter couldn't identify Hitler as Germany's chancellor during World War II. About 20% couldn't say who America fought in that war. More than a quarter believed Columbus sailed to the New World after 1750. Half didn't know about Senator Joseph McCarthy. Nearly a third couldn't tell you who said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And in terms of literature, the findings were even more abysmal. So we will be talking about that study and how to achieve excellence in education when it comes to history and what we mean by that, really having an excellent education in history and in literature. It should be a good hour. Martin Fletcher is with us now, NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv, and his book is Breaking News. We go next to Saeed from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guest about the coverage of Iran, reporting from inside Iran by the international press, and how it is so skewed. So skewed that the story of the struggle of the Iranian people for freedom is just not being told in the West. And my own opinion is that so many even seasoned reporters fall prey to the state management of the news. And let me give you some examples of that. CNN bureau chief in Tehran, a man who was a newspaper person who carried the water for the Shah pre-revolution, who then sold out to the regime and now is the CNN bureau chief, when asked why CNN did not report the killing of a student activist, Akbar Mohammadi, under torture in prison, said that was not news. That was only news to people who were trying to manipulate a regime change in Iran. Even seasoned reporters like Trudy Rubin and Ted Koppel cannot fall into the trap of never looking beyond their minders and never looking beyond what they consider to be chance encounters, which really are not, in interviewing the Iranian public. And on the other end of the spectrum, people like Zahra Kazemi, the Canadian broadcasting reporter, who dug beyond the red line that is understood by all reporters, the red line beyond which the state will not tolerate. Zahra Kazemi was killed in Iran for her genuine reporting. And PBS reporter who was kicked out of Iran because she tried to interview the families of fallen Iranian dissidents.
All right, let's get a response here. We have a lot of people on the line. Saeed, Martin?
Well, I think Saeed's making an excellent point, and of course I refer to the same thing myself earlier when I was saying that there's a large number of young people in Iran who don't necessarily support the regime at all, and I mentioned the my impression when I was there of the strength of the people. So I know what Saeed's getting at. That story, Saeed, that you mentioned of the CNN bureau chief, I don't know any of those details myself, but it's if true, pretty appalling. And I sympathize with you. I think that the part of the issue is that there probably isn't enough reporting on Iran anyway because of the difficulty probably of working there and being there. And that's what would lead to people not dwelling enough on the question of dissent. Because I must say, if I went to Iran to report, and I've been there for a long time, the first story I'd want to do, I think, would be to go find the young people and ask them what they thought of the regime and who supports Ahmadinejad and all his promises to wipe Israel off the map. So I think that surely is one of the most interesting stories. I can't answer why people haven't done it beyond proposing that not enough foreign journalists have gone to Iran recently to report from there. I'm sure that would be the first story we'd do.
Saeed, thanks for the call. Dave from Appleton, hi.
Hi. Fascinating show. I'd like to know whether the guest feels that his own organization, NBC, I mean, to hear someone as experienced as this being in a bureau anywhere with a major news organization is somewhat of a surprise to me, because I know they've been cutting back, and I wonder if he sees that trend as maybe part of the blinders that we have on, that we all get our news through one or two sources and people really aren't in the field anymore, if that he sees as a worrying trend.
Well, David, first of all, I'm glad to be speaking to you now, because who knows, I could be cut back any time. But I hope not. I think not. Yeah, look, it's a very worrying trend. I mean, there are far fewer people covering international news than before, and a lot of people are complaining about it and tearing their hair out of it. Looking at it from the company point of view, or from any media organization point of view, I mean, the fact is there isn't enough money now to do everything, and so they're being more careful where they spend their money, and there's a great move towards transferring resources to the Internet, which organizations think will down the road be the future. So there's actually a lot of foreign news on the Internet, a huge amount. If you go to MSNBC.com, or I'm sure ABC, CBS, or CNN, any of those organizations, there's a huge amount of foreign coverage. And as a matter of fact, I'm doing a lot more now for the Internet than I do for the broadcast network.
Mm-hmm.
So it's true to say there's less on the main newspapers and the main TV broadcast, but there's a lot more on the Internet. So it's a matter of where you go to find the news, and so many more people are going to the Internet. That's why we're transferring resources there. Having said that, the big change, especially in television, is that cameras are smaller. It's easier to send pictures live via computers and telephones. And so what you're doing is you're seeing fewer large teams of people and more one-person digital journalists who do it all. And they're normally young people without much experience in the field, a lot of experience with their technology, and to learning as they go along. And I don't think that's a bad thing. After all, I was once a young guy in the field with a camera. So, you know, you've got to start, and you've got to learn and grow. And hopefully there's enough old guys like me around to help guide the young guys. And personally, I love speaking to these young people because they're full of energy and enthusiasm. And, you know, they like to listen too. They're good journalists. So I don't dismiss that in the slightest. I'm all for it. But it is true that there are far fewer foreign bureaus than there were before, far fewer large bureaus than there were before. But also there's a growing number of one-man bureaus around the world, too, which is interesting.
Yeah. What about the news that's coming from Iraq? We've heard, Martin, that it is just so highly dangerous to report from there that we're not getting very many reports. We're getting them from Iraqi journalists who are putting their lives in danger to cover what's going on in that country. Is that a fair assessment of the news coming from Iraq?
Absolutely. I think something like 100 Iraqi journalists have been killed covering the news in their own country. And all of the organizations, including NBC, rely dramatically on the local people to provide, you know, the cameramen who go out and the producers who go and talk. And we have our own correspondents there. But it's very hard because if you're actually a target, that's a different ballgame than from what I'm used to, where you could get unlucky. If you're a target, that puts a whole new question. So now there's a whole new industry that's grown up of security guards, former servicemen, former soldiers who now act as bodyguards
for
the journalists. That limits what you can do because they're trying to keep you safe. You can't go out and speak to the people. Although we have some of our reporters do that, but they do it very quickly. You know, I mean, I'd love to spend a whole day with a family and just, even if it's going to be a short report, get to know them and get to do a better report. I mean, on the other hand, in Iraq, if you go somewhere, you can literally be there for 10 minutes before the word gets around that you're there, so you've got 10 minutes to work in. Obviously, the story you're going to do will have to be much more superficial than if you spend a day there.
Sure, yeah. One more call. We're almost out of time, everybody, so if we can make it brief. Ken from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Good to hear you back.
Thank you, Ken.
Quickly, I heard a report, I believe it was Thursday or Friday, that there's problems now on the southern border here in the United States with the electronic fence, and that was juxtaposed with the stories about the rocket attacks coming from Gaza into Israel. and I thought that it was very strange. And what kind of juxtaposition, you know, we're having problems here. Comments, please.
All right, we only have about 15 seconds, Martin.
I think that, you know, the thing that fences make good neighbors is not necessarily accurate. All fences are a sign of a failure of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, negotiations, new laws is a much better way to go.
Yeah. Martin, thank you so much for being with us and for all the work you've done for so many years.
Anthony, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Martin Fletcher, his book is Breaking News, Stunning and Memorable Account of Reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world. It has just been published by St. Martin's Press, and he has covered every conflict and natural disaster in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East for 35 years, has won tons of awards for his wonderful work. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls, everybody. A reminder, after 9 tonight, NPR News presenting coverage of the day's primaries in Texas, Ohio, Vermont, and Rhode Island.